So. Welcome.
Hey.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yeah, not yet, but in a couple of days. Yeah,
this is our consistency. Buzzwords.
Yay.
The 10th podcast of Instant Buzzwords.
And we have a guest for the first time. We are evolving. First time.
Hey, guys.
That's Patrick.
That's Patrick.
That's me, yes. Correct.
Newcomer. We have a very frequent podcast, that's for sure. I mean, the last podcast was last week, or was it last month, or was it...
I think it's more like 3 months ago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Apologies for that.
But management told me that they miss us.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, me too.
They just recognized 3 months after the fact, but they miss us. So, yeah, we thought we'd make a last podcast for the year and make a bit of a... Not actually review, but like open discussion, what was happening, and then maybe some of these people have some ideas what they do in the next year. I don't have any. I'm too busy doing my day-to-day work.
Yeah.
Saying something about their others' day-to-day work.
Yeah. That's more about it. But yeah, we try to have a little recap of 2016, whatever this means. We'll see. We had a very long preparation of like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So
do you need more?
No.
Okay. I start.
You start.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Go ahead.
So probably the best thing ever happened to humankind is Clojure Spec is out, which is a framework for specifying data structures and even functions. So Clojure has now the ability to say something about itself, which is kind of like spooky meta. So you spec certain structures, if you will, and then you can call verify, you can call a function called explain, you can call a function called comply, and you can even choose if you want to like validate or check your data structures in development time or in execution time of the program in production. It's very strong in terms, if you really nail it down, you can basically generate tests out of your specs. You can then, if you spec your functions, you can even generate functions and data for this function, so you have a fully tested code base where you just write the generators to get your tests.
You lost me already.
Yeah, I know. It's too much magic.
It's too much Clojure.
But should we...
It's just great.
Should we just start with a more general overview?
No.
There is no general overview from Clojure.
It is really important because, like, for instance, other languages try to go with types. And you have a type and you say, this is my type, blah, blah, blah. And then the compiler goes, nah, this is not type compliant.
This is what I do with Go.
Yeah, exactly. You define your interfaces, and then if you miss something in your interfaces, you have to recompile everything.
Right.
Well, this recompiling step is kind of there in Clojure too, but the thing is now that you still have the luxury of a dynamic type language where you can like basically go at runtime and change the language itself and do all kinds of nasty stuff, and you can have assurance for certain types of your certain kind or areas of your application, where you be very specific about something. So you just, or you can be more lax about it. You can say, my name is a string, but it has to be built out of 8 characters, for example. So you can make it specific, more specific to nail it down, or you can like relax it a bit and you have full power over this, where you can go, in Go, you have to basically, this is an in32-bit. And this is an in64-bit. You have to be, like, on another level, you are forced to be very specific where you might not want it or it might not make sense.
Yeah.
So get a JSON in, you want to pass an int.
Is
it 64-bit? Is it 32? No, it's an int. Fuck, it's JSON. Yeah. But in Go, you have to be overly specific.
You said death word.
Oh, shit.
No, anyways.
Yeah.
Okay, so you can, it's like types, but you can say it should be a string with only numeric.
And it's way more flexible. And you can like choose it. Do you have it at development time? Check for development time and get speed gains because not using it at runtime, or have security in your application by using it at runtime. And you have lots of flexibility having this, and it's actually powerful. Clojure.org, and then there's an entry about the latest Clojure spec, and there's a nice walkthrough. There are talks out there from Euroclojure where Karin Meyer showed self-healing code, basically with having specs and specing your functions and having a code that has a mistake, and you have another code base that complies somewhat to your spec that you assume, you can now exchange code from a different code base in Clojure and get the function into your code base and heal your function by exchanging the code bases. This is what you can do in Clojure. You can always manipulate the runtime and the code it's running, because homo iconicity, code is data and data is code.
Isn't it the same in Haskell?
No.
But can you... It's an Erlang, right?
Yeah, in Erlang you can exchange and you can get...
Because of functional, you can just say, okay, I replace this function with a new function, and then every subsequent execution...
I don't know if this would be more of a dynamic type falls into that area. Actually.
Exactly, yeah. It is. Also what I've said. Because it's in dynamic languages, you don't use the compiler itself. Like Ruby, for example, or JavaScript, you don't have a compiler itself. Like you can, at runtime, change anything.
So the interpreter has a stack, and in the stack, there's a listing of all the functions. Yeah, if you go my function, and you go my function now equals zero, then you replace the stack with that.
Yeah. And since it's...
That's dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So great stuff, awesome, amazing.
Amazing.
Also talking about that dynamic stuff, it's very important and interesting that Clojure comes up with this hot reloading stuff.
Yeah.
It's very interesting for coming from a JavaScript background, or especially React background, where you have React hot reloading. So you change something in React and then you get like the direct representation in the view layer, what you're looking at the view.
Oh.
Is it a segue to your first topic?
Well, I just wanted to mention it. We can let him finish first, but just wanted to mention that's a really interesting evolution, kind of, because maybe there will be more people looking towards Clojure coming from the JavaScript community because of that. Because it's really interesting to see that that it goes more and more into the same direction, like Elm, for example, the functional language which compiles to JavaScript, mostly used for games or like web pages or whatever. And then you have like Clojure, and then you have JavaScript nowadays with the Redux pattern. And all of those guys go more and more direction to these hot reloading stuff.
Yeah. So I would refer to it as a like interactive environment, development environment. So you just spin up your REPL, you throw code at it, it will be executed automatically. You can revert it, you can override it. Don't like you have a much faster feedback cycle in development, and that's curious.
Yeah, it's very nice. Yeah.
Then Elasticsearch 5 is out.
Yeah, wait. I think we should switch. So you had your first, and now it's
I don't think it's fair.
No, it's fair.
Clojure needs some time. Give Clojure some love.
So ECMAScript 6 and 7.
Yeah, I can just continue on this topic and then go ahead from there, because it's like what it makes possible, this hot reloading is of course like you have this dynamic stuff, and you have like in normal like ES6 and 7 you don't have types yet, so you have it's completely dynamic language, right? So there's so much more to come, and there's so much which went into the language in 2016.
This is ES7 now.
Yeah, ES6.
2016.
Exactly. ES6 is like 2015, basically. Okay. And it's a bit confusing.
Oh, it's a longer time ago.
Yeah,
like
yeah, exactly. And then this is what they call ES6. And then ES7 is kind of like ES 2016, but you get messed up there. Yeah. I mean,
and you have types now.
No, you don't. You go ahead with TypeScript, and there you have types. TypeScript is like a very old project, I would say, compared to other projects in the JavaScript world. It's not even JavaScript. It's JavaScript, basically, because you can have, this is the powerful stuff. You can write JavaScript and TypeScript in one file. It's working. You don't need to have like completely dynamic or completely typed language, which reminds me of that, what Hagen already mentioned with Clojure, that you have like, you can choose kind of how strict you want to follow the type system or not. The compiler is very effective towards that. Yeah.
But is this also using the Clojure S compiler from Google?
I'm not sure about that.
Is TypeScript?
I don't think so, no.
Yeah.
This TypeScript thing is just many meta language that you can compile, from which you can compile all the other JavaScript versions. So you type everything in TypeScript, or you program everything in TypeScript. And this will always be the latest, newest hotted stuff.
Yeah.
And then basically, you can just push out whatever ECMAScript or JavaScript you need, right?
Basically, yes. Yeah. TypeScript, the TypeScript compiler understands it. It's very effective. It's also, they built this visual code, which is also built into that thing. So it's from Microsoft, right? TypeScript. So visual code is also from Microsoft. So of course they have like the best. They claim to have the best integration of the compiler in Visual Code, but for WebStorm it's also very powerful. And what you just mentioned is also an interesting topic, because they always need to update the compiler for the new features of ECMAScript, right? For example, you have ECMAScript 12 or whatever, a new feature is in the language. What you're going to do to support that feature? You need to keep up with the compiler or not? These are some questions which they are also kind of not so 100% sure if they go to support every new step, or if they like make a batch like of all of the new features at one point. It's still an open topic for those guys.
So Microsoft has the hand over TypeScript.
Yep.
And who has the hand on ECMAScript?
That's the ECMAScript Foundation, basically, like the...
So you have basically like to follow, like to be compliant, you will now nail down an ECMAScript version, you will nail down a TypeScript version if you use TypeScript. And how do you, like, this is complicated.
Yeah, it is. But this is the nice thing, because we are just using it and not programming the compiler, so we don't need to care about that.
Yeah, yeah,
this
but is I all... mean, still, you can end up, like, looking at legacy code, mm-hmm. like... basically setting everything up to be on the newest version, and then how do you cope with backwards compatibility?
It's all backwards compatible, of course. I mean,
yeah, but that's what I want.
TypeScript will be they working a lot on that stuff, and they actually also for this is like going into like in the future with Angular 4. It's like the compiler will be even more better. What they say, they will optimize it.
So TypeScript, let's say in ECMAScript 6 you don't have while loops, and in Elastic, I always read ES as Elasticsearch, so that is like, but anyway, in ECMAScript 7 you have a while loop, and in TypeScript, for that reason, as it's only driving or go like ahead with the latest version, so you write a while loop in TypeScript. And then it will automatically go back to a for loop style in ECMAScript that just compiles it like that. So it will try to use the methods and functions available in each version so that it can comply with whatever is in the latest. So you just use the new functions, and then the compiler will make sure that it will be some hacky way, the best hacky way for older language versions.
It's basically... not really that he will not compile to, I think, not compile to ES7 or ES6, it will compile to ES5. Like the same approach that they're using with transpiling. Because you need to be careful, you write for browser, right? And the browser may be not even support ES6 features, still not. So, you need to be careful there, and that's why they like following the same approach that Babel transpiler does. It's transpiling back to ES5. So basically you write the code in ES7, the newest stuff, transpile it, and then it runs in every browser.
But this translation thing is not specific to TypeScript, right?
No, it isn't. That's a Babel. Babel is a transpiler.
Elasticsearch 7 again. So every time it's Elasticsearch 7, it's like
ECMA. I have now written it down. ECMA.
ECMA, yeah.
ECMA script, okay.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why, I mean, that's why it's so powerful. Because, and that's why also you can say that transpiling will never stop in JavaScript world. There are some people out there which are saying, at one point we don't need to transpile anymore because the browsers eventually support everything. But as the community goes forward and ECMAScript grows and grows and grows and they put more features into the language, and the browser manufacturers will be always a bit slower because putting that into the browser engine is always a bit more complicated than putting it into the language. Of course, that will be always slower, so it will always be transpiled to use the next gen.
But transpiling is possible with ECMAScript, and TypeScript is just a new evolution of this transpiling.
No, transpiling is possible with ECMAScript through a transpiler. This is like Babel, for example, or Google Traceur.
Yeah.
This is not really in use so much anymore. Everybody switched to Babel. And TypeScript has its own compiler, which compiles the type system, all of that stuff, into ECMAScript 5 at the end.
That needs to be done. And it's like there's also type erasure, right? It's like Java. So if you go... And have in Java, I don't know if you ever saw me sitting in code that goes, my awesome class that does stuff, and then I have this...
There's awesome stuff?
This brackets, and then I have another type in
These are
generics.
Yeah, exactly. I did this.
So, and these are hints for the compiler to go and optimize certain stuff, because it now can... What you do in Go with where you go, I have this in32 and I have the in64... You need to like duplicate your code to be compliant with your interface for both of these types. It's the same that Java needs to do with a generic. Once it does it for this type in the generic annotation, and once it does it for the other one.
Mm.
So now it has created the bytecode correctly with all these hints, and then it erases them because the original layout of the GVM specification doesn't allow for this kind of stuff. So actually, at runtime, you don't have the type insurance anymore. And that's now going back and hijacking the conversation again. This is what Clojure Spec does better. Because at runtime, you have the specification still in your code. And you lose it because like the original specification, the very lowest bottom of the definition, doesn't allow for this kind of stuff.
Okay, so in develop time and compile time, you have all this...
Yeah, and it does optimize and knows what to arrange and what to like put in and replace and what inline and what not to inline and blah, blah, blah. It's still very effective, though. It's still a marvelous piece of like optimizing source code.
Yep.
But to be really sure about what's going on at runtime, it's not there anymore. Nobody can at runtime say what was what.
Mm.
And you can with Clojure Spec. Yay!
And with TypeScript, they also introduce types, which is why they called it TypeScript, I guess.
Exactly. That's it.
And it's just a future-proof version of it, so that you have types.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that like far. Future-proof. That's tough for JavaScript.
It's just TypeScript, so...
Yeah.
I mean, TypeScript is a pretty old project. It's just like that now Angular 2 is written in it completely with TypeScript.
Mm.
Immutable.js is written in TypeScript. It's like more. You have more libraries which are actually written in TypeScript.
Okay.
And you have like, I mean, face it, right? We have like Angular 2 is like one of the most anticipated frameworks for the JavaScript world. And again, it will change the JavaScript world again, like React did, like Redux did, and like
yes,
also... Yeah, it will change it. And with Angular 2, you can write normal JavaScript, but they say like you should write TypeScript, and I think it's much more effective if you write TypeScript. And you need to do a lot of workarounds if you not use TypeScript. So more and more people will go into TypeScript right now, and they're working actively on the compiler, actively on the language. I think this is... Really,
but you need to use types in TypeScript.
You can also ignore a lot of types there. Yeah. You can basically get around the compiler. You can configure the compiler to be not so strict, basically. You have like a compiler options JSON configuration file, and then you can put some options
and
in
by
there.
By default, it's very strict, but by default, it's very loose.
I think there's some... I mean, it depends what you mean with very strict. I mean, if you go where we're coming from Java, maybe, where it's, I would say, very strict.
But stupidly strict.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like Scala is kind of like, I think there is some, should be in a modern, relatively new written compiler, there should be some type inference capabilities.
Yeah, it is. And it's completely type inference.
And, I mean, it just.
But there are like, there's like, this is another podcast. I can show you a scheme where you go like the strengths of a type system itself and what it can do at a certain level. And Java's type system belongs to one of the weakest.
Yeah.
But it's still very complicated if you have a large code base and everybody messes. Clojure doesn't have a type system. It inherits a basic type system of the GVM. So a string must be a string, an integer is an integer, blah, blah, blah. But on top of those more complex objects, these are not types. In Clojure not, but and Java belongs really to the still better type system already. And with Java 8 or 7, they introduced some inferencing. But if you compare Scala's type system to Java's type system, it's like, this is... future stuff, like really future stuff. And then you have Idris and OCaml and Haskell as the supposed more supreme type systems, but I doubt that TypeScript is at that level of...
I'm not sure, actually. They're using a very intelligent type inference there. And
Their words or your words?
Their words. And
But go to any website of any publisher and go, it's amazing
stuff. But the thing is, you need to see that those guys are not working in isolation. They are looking at constantly at new, at older and newer type systems. Yeah. And I think the type system there is very intelligent. Yeah.
Okay. There's a lot to learn from the past. That's what historians say all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's why it's very...
But are we humans not like... I'm capable of learning from history?
Depends.
So now you want to say something about a container engine called Rocket? I think it's your turn now.
I just want to cut this talk about languages and just ease and make the listeners a little bit more patient. Yeah, I thought to talk a little bit about Docker orchestration or Linux containers orchestration.
It's a strange way you pronounce Rocket.
Yeah, he's trying to troll me, but it's okay.
I see even LXC. How come?
Oh, it's harmed me from the past. No, I think 2016 was very nice in terms of orchestration of Linux containers to make it more broad.
Oh, yeah.
The beginning of the year, you had like Docker Run and some... Mm-hmm.
We were writing compose files already.
Yeah, we are very advanced. I mean, that was like a huge step.
If you say so, yeah, I wouldn't argue with that.
Now, I think 2016, with all the Docker features in the data engines and the Docker services, Docker Swarm, and all this orchestration fitting that comes in, it was a very successful year for this kind of. I mean, running containers is cool. But running multiple containers is what you really want to do. You don't want to run a container in isolation.
Yep.
So you need to compose it somehow. And the Docker orchestration has come a long way, I think. And maybe 2017 will be even more and better and easier orchestration for the masses.
So the big game for me was in 2015, I was having my Docker compose files and I had my small little Swarm cluster and connecting it, and then I had always this network issue. So coming, I don't know, was it Docker 10?
Docker 1.9. Networking, yeah.
And that was a huge step forward. Not linking, not relying on like binding to the host, but then be on a virtual network. That was such a huge step and such a luxury in the file to, I have these stuff and that network, I have this stuff and that network, and okay.
Yeah, that would be looking back to 2015, right? Yeah, I mean, before you had to expose...
I was not using it in 2015. I was just using it in 2016. I was just like...
Yeah,
giving it, like, I think that was valuable. I now understand some of it better. and I can work with it.
Yeah, we all do. We all
helps me. Yeah, yeah, but you are like also ops background stuff. I'm just a stupid developer. I can do nothing. Completely incapable of anything.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
Yeah, no. Fallout. You don't say yeah, no. What does it mean?
No. No, I just looking at the time and we are almost half an hour in, so I will cut my part short.
Why?
Because hey. it's
come on, it's Docker.
We all agree that Docker is awesome and yeah. Orchestration is awesome. Yeah, it's so awesome. It's like, okay. Mm-hmm. So I think, who's next? About Elasticsearch.
Yeah, I speeding it up. So Elasticsearch 5 is out. I think even 5.1 is out. nice features, Lucene 6 something, and we fixed some stuff. They fixed some stuff. I didn't do anything. we have doc values everywhere. We have more standard tokenizer stuff and specific fields for keywords and text, where you now go, yeah, most of, like in analytics for logs and metrics and events, you would want to do all this aggregation stuff that Elasticsearch provides, but therefore you don't want a field to be analyzed, and they have now built two fine abstractions to go, okay, this is a string value that goes as is. For instance, if you say this is my application game, you rarely want to have a full text search on this, but then you have a description or an exception. You want to have this as a full text search field. Nice things. Then they built this plugin for Kibana called TimeLion, which I'm very excited about because it also does these anomaly detection. They improved even more the Percolator API, where you can alert on specific indexing tasks. So say I index an event with the thing not available data node or not available anything, and I can alert on this specific thing and then even alert on other subfields. So maybe I'm just interested in my high availability applications, and if they go down, I want to be alerted, but I don't want to be alerted if like some, I don't know, development environments goes down. I don't want to send alerts for this. You can now can be very specific about this alerting with Elasticsearch. And then I have an interesting bug in Elasticsearch 1.7 version that I never saw before. I only saw this in high traffic scenarios, where you can index into a shard a document, and into another shard, a document with a conflicting mapping. It does, if this goes at high volumes of indexing load, it will end up writing a conflicting mapping for one index, but different shards, and then it has a flapping shard where it never can reallocate a specific shard because of a conflicting mapping, and you cannot get rid of it. You basically have to remove the index. Wow. Because you cannot, like, You can remove the shard manually, you can delete the shard, but yeah, it like you get conflicting writes, which I never experienced before with Elasticsearch. They make now this operation where they sync the mapping when an update's happening across shards in one index. This is now synchronous and not asynchronous anymore. But yeah, we will see how this ends up when we have more experience with using the newer version of Elasticsearch. But that was an interesting bug I encountered this year with Elasticsearch. And that's for like my pet peeve, Elasticsearch. Done.
Yeah, I just want to hijack this a little bit because you said that TimeLion introduces like alerting and all this.
No. Percolator feature is from the beginning of Elasticsearch. Percolation, like looking at what kind of index is being indexed, and I have a percolator configured for it, I get alerted. That's a percolation feature of Elasticsearch. It's very old. The TimeLion plugin for Kibana, that's a new one, and this does, for some graphs, for some metrics, you can have anomaly detection in TimeLion.
This is different. TimeLion is the interface, right?
TimeLion is a UI where you follow, I don't know, some data you index in a timely fashion.
Yeah.
CPU value. And then TimeLion itself can go and detect you have a CPU spike.
Yeah.
But this has nothing to alert on that CPU spike. You would configure now a percolator and send it to Elasticsearch and register it and say, if I see in that time interval an uprising value of like this, please alert me.
Yeah. Yeah, this is
what, different.
This is what I saw in 2016, or I think we saw in 2016 a lot, that each and every data stack tries to include everything now. Like, you have an InfluxDB, you have this tick stack where you have the collector, I forgot the name, something with a T, I forgot.
Yeah.
And then you have InfluxDB.
Maybe T collector.
No. And,
how about test coverage, by the way? No, I'm getting sorry.
So Elasticsearch has beats, and so you have, like, for each stack you have a collector, you have the storage, you have an alerting engine,
you have a UI, and transmission, like a transport mechanism.
Yeah, even. And everyone has its own, basically.
Yeah.
And every stack tries to get this together, and they open source, or they have an open source storage. But all the complete stack, they try to make money on it. I mean, it's not a shame, it's okay, but...
Well, okay, I have to say something about it, because I'm actually annoyed by this. Elasticsearch does now what they call XPack, where you get everything but some very special feature you actually want that are not included. Now, see, the printer is going on.
Yeah.
So it says the printer. Yeah, we had to...
That is totally on purpose.
Our studio now features a printer which randomly jumps on and prints. We have to apologize for it.
No, we don't. But you already did, so we already did.
Whatever. Hi, printer. Merry Christmas.
No, but say something about the stuff you wanted to say something about. Don't get derailed by the
printer.
I'm sorry.
Where was I? Yeah, I think it's the fault of the investors. It's not like finance managers and investors. You force a company who has a great open source product. They found it. They want to make a living out of this.
So you blame capitalism.
But yeah. You cannot make a living out of it unless you spend like 2 digits of million or even 3 digits of millions. Now everybody has to like cope up with their investors and make a business plan and then blah blah blah, and this becomes now all very complicated, and it's not even open source. If you try to contribute to Elasticsearch, you have to have like a paper book worth of contracts that actually gives you like, you go to hell if blah 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 blah. And this is not open source. And then the thing with Docker, the company, where you cannot have on GitHub a repository go Docker my application or Docker something, because it's now a trademark name and this forbids anything, and this is just stupid. It's a effing name.
They didn't enforce it. I mean,
yeah, they did enforce it, but it's like for the investors, intellectual property stuff. It's all going wrong under the name of open source software.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they bundle this big packages, which have no, like, we have decent collectors already. We have decent messaging mechanism. Any big company uses a big queue and not coming on with like a Ruby implementation for shifting data around your data center.
Yep.
Nobody uses Logstash in a real big scenario. Nobody does that.
Okay, I just put a marker in Hagen's rant about capitalism.
Oh.
But I mean, that's, but this is how it goes, right? You get venture capital money and they say, yeah, we support this open source project. And then the first 3 rounds are all about contributing and getting this up to speed.
Yeah, and then lockdown.
And then the fourth round is like, okay, now we should make money. So,
and it's a big waste of resources. That's my opinion. It's just we have this... If they were all working together, we would have a decent NoSQL databases with strong consistency assurances. We could have, like, there can be so much improvement, but we waste all this resource and throw it across the planet, not focusing on really, like, Elasticsearch is a nice search engine, so what? And Influx is a nice metrics backend. But it's all good. Just improve it. And don't go and say, yeah, we are the new Oracle. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. This is just a bit too big. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
You're right.
It's okay. It's
a good point.
You're right. But I think to be the devil's advocate...
Yeah, you cannot start. Like the Simon Lindauer guy from Elasticsearch, he lives here in Berlin, around the corner. I don't say it, but it's not far away from here. He contributed 10 years to Lucene. Then they founded Elasticsearch together with a guy from Amsterdam. And yeah, they couldn't get $1 million for like actually funding a company if they not were to go this way.
Yeah.
But it's a shame.
Yeah, but
he is a real like open source contributor, but now he is like a businessman.
What are you proposing? That we have a tax on something and that we just...
Can we build a wall or make something great again? I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. Now let's stop this.
That was it. Like,
yeah, this is the end of the conversation. Just go for it.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's talk about something nice. Inventory, I see.
Is it
there's a nice open source project on GitHub.
No, let's talk about Redux.
Okay. Yeah,
yeah. Explain it to me.
Let's make first, because I just jumped in at my first part, so maybe to looking back at 2016 is more like Redux was already out, of course, but it got more momentum in 2016 and more, and I introduced it in, I think, two companies I introduced it, and I was like making a lot of evangelism towards it, because it's really good. It's really nice to understand, even in a huge code base.
Can I explain it in like 5 sentences what it does and what it's there for?
It's basically a predictable state container. It's like what the headline is. Underneath it, it's like it builds on top of the Flux architecture, which was built from Facebook. And the Flux architecture is like a uni-way data flow concept, where you have like for example in a two-way data flow, you have like changing data. For example, a model is changed from another point, which is the view, and the view is changed by the model, right? And
so this would be the Angular 1 pattern.
this is called two-way binding.
Yeah.
And Flux is uniway. It's like one-way data flow. It means you have like in Flux you have like a store, and not necessarily one store. You have like different stores for different parts of your application, right? For example, a store for a customer, a store for a user, a store for article or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And these stores are the data holders, if you will,
It's a
key value stores, if you will, just in the front end, basically.
It's a dictionary.
Yeah, it's a dictionary, basically. It's exactly. And those guys, they are getting updated via actions. And actions are triggered from somewhere. Let's say from the view, from a action button or whatever. And this is basically what it is. There is no reducers in Flux, in the Flux pattern. It's like you have like the store, you have actions and the view is triggering the action, and then it goes back and updating the store. So there is no like reducer pattern in there or something like that. That was introduced by Redux. Mm-hmm. Also, what was introduced by Redux is have only one store, but this was not 2016, to be clear. That was like, I think, 14.
Holy moly.
15 or 14.
It has a long
I'm not really already. Sure. I'm getting old, so the years are getting so fast.
Tell me about it.
So, exactly. So,
let's go now in detail. Not the detail to this, but yeah.
So, having like one store, he introduced the founder introduced like this time travel debugging, because of one store it's possible. The reducers are stateless, so you hit the reducer and the reducer is updating the slice of the store, which is basically a table of the dictionary, right?
Yeah.
The reducer, and so on. So the uniway data flow in Redux is basically you have the store, one store rules them all.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the action triggers the reducer. The reducer represents one slice of the store, and then the store is updated. And the representation layer is basically just showing what the store at that certain state. So you can go back and forth between the states by dispatching actions, basically. That's it.
Oh, now you can. Is that not an easy way to go and have the undo pattern?
Exactly. You get that for free.
You get that for free. You go just backwards the actions.
Yep. That's time travel debugging also. That makes it possible.
Time travel debugging.
That's what they call it, yeah. That's not my invention.
It's a fancy name.
Are you fiddling around with my feet here?
Yes. I'm sorry. Just
saying, I have a new.
It's getting hot in here.
I have another BFF now, and hopefully he listens at some point to get the reference.
Yeah. So just to go back to the looking back to 2016. It's like this Redux pattern, of course, awesome stuff, especially in combination with React and ECMAScript 6 and 7 and so on. Very nice stuff. You can really write clean code and have very nice patterns like encapsulation going on and everything, which kind of you're missing in like legacy systems. Also, you can do that in Angular 1, but there's a lot of stuff going wrong if you don't know what you are doing, which is most of the times at the beginning of Angular 1 was like because the examples were like, yeah, here, put everything on the global scope and you get it for free. This is what huge systems are built on. And to refactor that into a componentized system, it's a lot of work, but it's possible. But it's always, you need to see if it makes sense. And there are also like some efforts where you have like Redux working in Angular 1, which kind of brings me to the next step, having Angular 2 with Redux. Which was for me, first Angular 2 was for me like, I don't really want to go into it. Because I really like Redux, I like the clean approach of Redux, I like more the functional approach also. And for me, Angular 2 was like, again, the fully fledged framework where you can choose your own path in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in Redux, you have like, now, like nowadays, you could say you have like pretty much straightforward workflow, which you could say if you look at the Redux application, it looks the same than the other Redux application, right? It's kind of it's not a framework, it's not opinionated. It's a library, so you can use it in the way you want. That's why people missing this opinionated stuff and also like more frameworks sometimes. That's why people come up with Saga, for example, which is kind of a framework using Redux to make it more opinionated, which I never used. I was always like in front of using it the way you want, because this is like a good thing in my mind. But also in my mind, it's clearly if everybody is doing what he wants, then you end up like you will never understand the Redux. You understand the Redux pattern, but you don't understand like how people using it in their data flow in their applications. So, but what makes it so powerful is the simpler, because it's so simple. Because it's so, yeah, exactly, simplicity. Because you have like one store, you have like the reducers and the actions, and then you have containers, and which are connected to the Redux store. Containers is the view layer, basically. It's like the thin layer in the view which connects the store to the view layer. And then you only render out components which are stateless. And you have only one container, like one stateful container for each store slice. And this is like, but this is not Redux, this is the React Redux pattern. This is another library which was made by open source also. A lot of people were involved there.
But just to jump in and to make it clear to at least my stupid Java head, anyway. You have this containers, they are just representing or rendering what is in the store. And you say, okay, this key is associated with this container, and if this key changes, then boom.
Yep.
Or if this tree, so is this subtree, something in the subtree is changing, then boom.
Yep.
This container, right?
Exactly.
Like you would say any view component, what you see on an application in a browser, is kind of subscribed to the model behind it. And the way the data flows is now optimized, which was not before, in terms of processing and data flow and simplicity. Like you can, it basically, this button with a name on it is represented here in that dictionary as a single point in the application. And if I manipulate that model, this changes automatically. And the way it has been done in between is simpler, way simpler and cleaner than ever before.
You don't need an action that is a viewer action. You just, this data processing until it hits the store is just transparent to the view.
What you just described is more like the two-way data binding flow. If everything is like represented via a model, for example, the button would like is basically directly hooked to the model, and the model is directly hooked to the button. So the button is pushed and changed the model directly. Like in Relax world, it would be more like the button is dispatching an action. That's it. He doesn't know anything about the data. And what you said, not every component is connected to the store, only one. This is like, this is the really important pattern for this. This is what people are getting wrong. This is the most important thing. And this is what makes it so easy to work with. You have like one container which is connected to one slice of the store. For example, the user container. And the user container is connected to the user's slice of the store, representing it and making encapsulation for the actions which can getting dispatched to change that slice of the store.
And only that slice of the store.
Exactly. Because these actions will trigger the reducer, and the reducer will have only access to this one slice of the store. And the reducer is basically a stateless function which is doing some whatever, like data manipulation. And after that, it goes back into the store. But the reducer is before the store. So the cycle is store, action, reducer, store. This is the cycle. So if you dispatch an action with new data, this is the payload for the action. You have an action type and the payload. And this goes into the reducer. The reducer knows the type, user updated with name, whatever. Gets the new name, says user.name is now the new name, and it should be immutable. So create a new user object, add the name to it, return it, always make a copy or whatever. Like with immutable JS, that's much more convenient because Redux itself is not immutable because it's JavaScript, right?
But so, before we jump into immutable JS, so the actions are always triggered by the container now. So
let me catch on that. No, the thing is, a good practice is that you define, we have classes, right? In ECMAScript 7, just side note, or 6 already. So the container is a class, right? A container class. And this class having all the functions for dispatching actions. For example, update username, update user, whatever.
And telephone number.
Yeah, whatever, exactly. And in there you say dispatch something and grab the payload from the view or from whatever you dispatch the action at. Then the action is getting dispatched from a component, from a stateless component, because you pass down your actions as functions, but not calling them, but only passing them down, because functions are objects, basically. You can pass down everything towards components. But this goes more into React now. This is like you have the container, and the container is connected to the Redux store, and it defines all of the actions which can update the slice of the store, right? Mm-hmm. Basically triggering the reducers with the panel. So this is done. The container is stateful, and he knows how you update the stuff he owns. He owns the slice, and he knows how you update it.
And that's why you only have one container per slice, because he has to be in charge of it.
Exactly. Because otherwise it will be hard to follow up again. Mm-hmm. And then inside of that container, there's this best practice that you're not rendering anything in the container. You're just rendering one other component. And this component is a just normal, plain, old, good old React component, which doesn't know anything about Redux. It's just getting the properties from the container, which can be some slice part of the store. Maybe the username to represent it, the action functions, the callbacks. You pass down the action functions, and inside of the component, which is basically a template, the other components getting rendered. So then you go inside of the of your component tree, and somewhere in the tree, we come back to that button Argen was mentioning. This is the button. This is just one component, and this component gets as properties the function which updates the store.
Mm-hmm.
And if you click there, this function is getting called, and then it goes. The action is triggered, which is calling dispatch on the store. The store getting updated via the reducer, right? It's like store,
mm-hmm.
action, reducer. And the store is updated, so the username is updated. So the container is saying, ah, okay, the store has changed because it's connected to the store. The store has changed and now the username is not Patrick anymore, but it's Christian. And then the part of the slice, the store, which was passed down to the component, will be now reflected again.
Mm.
So now the username component will show your name instead of mine.
Yeah.
So this is like the UniWay data flow concept. Yeah.
This all sounds like we should make like an Elasticsearch now.
Yeah, that all sounds, forget about let's do Elasticsearch more.
Let's we should do it in JavaScript, TypeScript, Redux, React.
Nah, you actually, like in modern times, you have no need for that at all. You just use ClojureScript
in modern times. Maybe in 20 years or so.
But and you were like explaining it to me, basically just moving your hands like, that's not podcast, right?
Yeah, I tend to do that. That's...
But let's move on. I mean, we should make an episode about this anyway, I think.
Yeah, let me just, to close it, one more thing.
Wrap it up.
It's like, I said that I didn't like to switch to Angular. And that's because I really like the ideas behind the Redux patterns and all of that stuff. But there's NGRX for Angular too. This is written also by really cool guys, which are, like me, loving Redux. And they don't want to lose that pattern. They actually introduced that pattern on top of Angular 2. And now you can use Redux pattern inside of Angular 2, mm-hmm. where you have the reducer, where you have one store for each Angular 2 application, and you have the actions, and you have the templates which are representing that. Yeah. And at the end, now I came up with some other guys also, we came up with a good idea how to put React inside of Angular 2, that you have like the Redux pattern and also like some other stuff which goes to Fano, that's like RxJS and stuff. We can really make a whole episode about that one. But it's like having now all of that combined, the Redux pattern inside of the Angular 2 framework makes it really more or less easy to have it solving the data flow problem and having the view represented by something else. That was what I think is very, very powerful, because in my I have like strong concerns to commit myself and a whole team to just one framework, and this is now what we're doing. Because then that was also a lot of people suffering now with Angular 1. And for me, there's no argument really about that. You should be always flexible about it. So at the end, yeah, to wrap this really up now, at the end, I would say, now I would use Angular 2, but in combination with the Redux pattern, because that makes it flexible. I can throw away Angular 2 at some time in the future, at some point, and say, okay, but it's still, my business logic is in the reducers, and my actions are triggering the changes, so I can go ahead and say, okay, I can still, with much less pain, move to another part of the world of JavaScript or whatever, TypeScript or whatever it would be. Yeah.
That would be saying that this podcast anyway, that you should not follow, that's what I said like a couple of months ago, that you should not fall in love with any particular framework or whatever, just stay agnostic as much as possible, and then you can... Go ahead.
I love you too. It's getting hot in here again.
Okay. I just wanted, but it's just a segue into my next thing, that I think with this, what you all talked about, it might be pretty easy, or hopefully it will be easy, and looking forward to 2017 already, mm-hmm. that creating simple UIs and maintaining them even for JavaScript newbies like me, like having a little Go daemon that presents JSON. Yeah! just representing JSON or just pushing JSON, and then you have a simple UI that just provides you a visualization for it. I think that would be something that I would really look forward to in the future. Yeah, Hagen, Kafka streams in Clojure.
Oh, this is amazing stuff.
Amazing stuff.
So, how are we, by the way, with time? Are we not like
one
going
hour,
for long?
Almost.
Yeah, we should give it an end. So yeah, Kafka 10 is out this year, even at 10.1 now, 0.0, we should always say it's still a zero in front. 0.10, 0.1, and 0.10.1. With the streaming API for Kafka, we talked in the former episodes about it a bit. I have now this API, the streaming API, is actually so simple and trivial and nice to use that it's even simpler to put it in like the Clojure interop stuff, and then yeah, it's just like I can I would just open my IDE, nobody else can view it, but I would just it's marvelous and simple. So I'm actually thinking of making it a library and write a little macro where you just go, pass in this function, give me the type of the topic I'm consuming, like what does it look like, mm-hmm. the data, and then give me the name for the output topic, and done. And then you pass in a function and you just transform. And that's the nice thing. If you, if you have this streaming API and I have this one jar, I can put it on like 10 machines, and Kafka will like distribute the traffic across all these small little processors and then throw it back into the result topic. And then at the end, if you say, I don't know, I'm calculating something, and put it in the result topic, you have another sync that subscribes to the result topic and throws it in the database of your preference, and then you're good. And that I'm really amazed because yeah, the old consumer API and still the Java stuff, or even if you look at some Scala stuff, it all looks really... Yeah, you need to know your stuff, but...
Yeah, I hear some not so positive thoughts about Scala in your voice.
No, it's
not just like slightly...
It's a subtle.
No, it's just... I think it's really hard to read, but...
Coming from Clojure? Or you don't come from Clojure in a way, but you love Clojure, so...
Yeah, it's...
You can argue about that.
No, I can... I grew up with Java, basically. Mm-hmm. I can write and read Java, I would say, more or less fluently. But there are so many constructs and concepts in Scala that you like really need to be... Am I getting F tier or not? What is like doing? And then there is... You need to really understand a lot of computer science concepts in order to cleanly read Scala code.
Okay.
It's the same with C++. You can go and have a very simple C++ file, which basically complies with C,
mm-hmm.
and then you go, okay, I know what it's doing. Here I have a struct, here I have a function, and mm-hmm. this is the interface, and here's the implementation, and done.
Yeah.
But you can have C++ code that does all kind of weird stuff and uses concepts that are just really complex, and if you're like not trained on a daily basis with understanding them, mm-hmm. you're getting lost very fast.
Yeah.
And that's a bit similar, I feel, to Scala. It's like,
good point.
Holy moly, is this this or is this that? Or if this is combined with this and that, is this now completely a different behavior? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. No, but this is just basically it. 32.
Yeah, I think we touched on all our points basically, right?
10 lines of code is. So I configure.
I configure my
Kafka.
Yeah, but this.
I configure serialization and this. I know it's not worth for the listener.
Video yet.
And
just, can you please shut it down?
Where's the screencast?
It's I don't know. It's just.
Yeah, but it looks beautiful.
Yeah,
and
Kafka is. Kafka now provides a very simple way to do a certain type of stream processing. Mm. And not the overly all complex machine learning, full-fledged, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, you can get decent stuff done stream processing-wise in a scalable fashion. And that's very cool.
Yep.
That's cool indeed. Yeah, cool. So
Are we done?
Do we do a little lookout for 2017, or do we think that's enough? We have 1 hour now. Maybe a little bit. So I'm looking forward.
Do this.
I'm looking forward to monitoring, logging, inventory, and all this jazz for containers. It's going to be awesome because it's not done yet in legacy, I think. And but this is the same. I mean, there are a lot of projects like we talked about. This everyone creates his own UI and alerting and all this jazz. I think that we will see in 2017 that each project that has anything to do with orchestrating or composing stacks will come up with. We try to come up with a solution, and I'm not sure if we can make it so that we have like a common way of doing things. At least for open for tracing, which is also very nice next
How year. About a collection Reinheitsgebot? So you yeah. do it one way and just one way, and that yeah. results in a whatsoever decently good beer, yeah. metrics collector.
Yeah, but nowadays it's not that good anymore. That's another topic.
Yeah, maybe we can agree on the communication channel, having something like Avro, like a schema that will verify that this. Uh-huh. We'll see. That's going to be very interesting. And tracing as well, it's also like adds to it. Open tracing, I recently learned about, that's pretty cool. And yeah, 2017 is going to be awesome.
Is it a prime number?
What about this prime number?
2017. Can you something? Is it a prime number?
Maybe. It's
I would. An odd number. I would say 80% yes, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sorry for the. I think our audio setup today is a little bit suboptimal. And I start.
It's a prime number.
Yes. And I knew it.
So dark demons will arise from the ground up for everybody who uses pointer-based programming languages.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
a prime number year.
Yeah.
Right.
Hear my words.
Yeah, mark your words. And November is also a prime number, like 11. So,
ooh.
No, just want to say, our audio is not the best, but 2017 we will improve, I think. Because yeah. I'm now using Ultraschall, I put in chapter marks. So that's awesome.
Yep.
And we will come back from 2016, or we will slide into 2017 with an
You think we'll do set. Another one in the future?
Yeah, sure we do. I just bought a license for a Reaper, so we have to.
Okay, that sets some pressure on it.
Okay, yeah, well.
And good. We will do awesome stuff. So guys,
yeah, thank Christmas. You for producing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, someone has to do it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, has to do it right.
Yeah, that I'm not sure about. Let's talk about right in another thing. Yeah.
Okay,
cool. Cool, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Merry Christmas, vacation.
Happy New Year.
New Year, slide into New Year.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Ciao.